From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On the panel this week, we have Paul Brandes, White House Bureau Chief of West Wing Reports, and Dan Raviv, Washington correspondent for I-24 News. And here are the issues. North Korea's nuclear standoff with the world worsened. The regime of Kim Jong-un said that they had tested a powerful hydrogen bomb. The United States drafted a United Nations Security Council resolution that would ban all imports of oil and fuels to North Korea, although such an embargo is likely to be blocked by China and Russia. 700,000 immigrants without legal papers who are brought to America as children find themselves in limbo. At first, President Donald Trump said he would scrap an Obama-era action that shields such so-called dreamers from deportation, calling on Congress to resolve their fate. But within hours, Mr. Trump signaled he might act to let them stay, causing confusion. More than 100,000 Rohingya Muslims fled Myanmar in the space of 10 days, many arriving in next-door Bangladesh, accusing the government and military in Myanmar of violent repression. Mostly Buddhist Myanmar says that terrorists are killing civilians. And America's UN ambassador Nikki Haley put Congress on notice that it may have to decide whether to reimpose sanctions on Iran next month if President Trump formally declares the Islamic Republic is cheating on a 2015 nuclear weapons deal. So it's a very busy news week. It begins and ends with nuclear standoffs, but the one that has really thrust its way to the front of the news agenda is clearly North Korea, with this very aggressive series of missile tests and weapons tests. The jury is out, Paul Brandes, as to whether this was actually a hydrogen bomb, but it was clearly a very powerful device that was tested. And the United States responded with the sternest sanctions package that we have seen to date. Tell us where we are this week.
Well, I think the first thing is that President Trump has really, from a rhetorical standpoint, almost boxed himself in with this very tough language he said about a month ago after a prior missile test that he would simply not permit this to go much further. He threatened North Korea essentially with destruction. And in a news conference this week at the White House, he said it would be a very sad day if they continued with this. Now, this so-called hydrogen bomb has not been actually confirmed, but there are reports that residents in China across the border had their homes shake and so forth. So clearly something very powerful happened. And that's really where we are. I mean, the United States also says, the president said that this is not the time to talk to North Korea, and yet his officials say that diplomacy is still an option and so forth. So mixed signals, in essence, that we see from the White House.
And Dan Raviv, if I were sitting here as a spokesman for the White House, I would say, no, President Trump has not boxed himself in. His very strong language is changing the attitude of countries like China. They are becoming more willing to impose the kind of tough sanctions that might finally change the minds of the North Korean regime. Now, that's what a White House spokesman would say if they were sitting here. Is there a way of telling whether that's really true on the ground? How will we know whether China's calculus is changing?
Well, diplomacy is usually behind the scenes, and on a subject like this, I'd say even more so. Now, Donald Trump tries to change the paradigm, the way worldwide diplomacy is done, by also injecting the occasional unexpected public remark, and sometimes it's on Twitter. Now, on Twitter, he indicated that he's giving up on China, that China tried to help, but wasn't able to, but the time for talk is over, and as you say, in public, President Trump decided to remind the world that the U.S. military could destroy the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. But you know what? He didn't talk about South Korea, the Republic of Korea, an important U.S. ally, an important industrial country. The defense minister, retired General James Mattis, has said that the destruction in South Korea would be unacceptable and terrible. But the president doesn't talk about that. So what I think is going on, to the extent that it's coordinated, and here in Washington, some people wonder if it is. But I do think it is. This is a big issue. It's called the good cop, bad cop, on its simplest terms. And that would be where the bad cop, at least, is President Trump himself, always talking about the fact that there's a military option and the U.S. military is ready. In one message on Twitter, he said it's locked and loaded. Now, the good cops, of course, include the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, maybe James Mattis, though he's in charge of the military, but very experienced, very measured in what he says. And clearly, the U.S. is still willing to engage in diplomacy, if not with North Korea at this point, then with China, Russia, and other countries that might be willing to tighten sanctions or do something that actually might change North Korea's course. It's not likely to happen, but I think the U.S. government does have a plan, good cop, bad cop.
Now, Paul, the language used not just by this president, but by every American president going back, more than a generation now, is that they wanted a denuclearized North Korean peninsula, and that it is not acceptable for North Korea to have nuclear weapons. Is there a sense that that is becoming a rhetorical position but isn't actually where we are? Is there a sense now that they have made so much progress that actually maybe we're edging, although we can't say it in public, to living with some level of nuclear capability in North Korea? And so we're into containment as opposed to demanding that they remove their nuclear weapons and have no weapons of any sort?
Well, there's a sense here that asking or demanding, somehow finding a way to force North Korea to give up their nuclear weapons, how would that process work? I think in North Korea, part of their calculus looks at what happened in, say, Libya in 2003 when Muammar Gaddafi, who was then the leader, agreed to give up his nuclear weapons program. And then in 2011, of course, the United States and NATO actually bombed Libya and so forth. So Kim Jong-un can look to history and say, well, perhaps it's not such a good idea for me to do that. There are some analysts who say that North Korea sees its nuclear weapons as a security guarantee. The United States has never gone to war against another nuclear power, and that's part of the calculus. So when people say that we can somehow force them to give up their nuclear weapons, how does that actually play out?
And Dan, just finally before we turn to another topic, we have this very stern draft United Nations Security Council resolution that the US wrote that would effectively have a sort of naval blockade around North Korea, not just stopping weapons materials, but also crude oil, with the power to search ships without permission going in. So a naval blockade, a naval embargo, yes. Basically. There are other members of the UN Security Council that have a veto. Russia and China. What's going to happen to this resolution? Is this naval embargo going to happen?
Well, it does look like Russia or China or both will veto it, but we're not absolutely sure. Deals can be made in the background. I know that would be a favorite Donald Trump-type phrase. And there have been surprises for many that Russia and China have gone along with previous votes in the United Nations Security Council for harsh sanctions against North Korea. But a naval blockade, cutting off everything going into that country, is often considered an act of war. Nothing is more serious. I'll be surprised if it happens, but something's got to happen in that North Korea story.
And of course, China's calculus is it does not want to collapse the North Korean regime. So it's very hard to see China.
Right. That would be even worse. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So turning to news at home, which is of intense political interest here in Washington, D.C., but is also, for an awful lot of people, a very human story. We have nearly 700,000 so-called Dreamers, these mostly young, mostly Hispanic residents of the United States, many of whom went to school here, went to college, have jobs here. But they were brought here by their parents when they were children, and they didn't come with the right legal papers. So they've been living in the shadows. They were given legal protections, Paul, by President Obama. That program has always been a target of a lot of hostility from some on the right. Donald Trump looked as though he was giving a kind of late summer, early autumn present to the hard right by scrapping that so-called DACA scheme. But it turned out to be a lot more complicated.
Well, the backdrop to this is that this is an administration that in general is skeptical of the value of immigration. The president has surrounded himself with a series of advisors. Some have departed, but he still has some with him who are very skeptical of that. The president promised as a candidate that he would scrap the so-called DACA program on his very first day in office. Here we are about 8 months later, and he's finally getting getting around to saying that that yes, it will be rescinded. But he now says it will be after 6 months. He tweeted earlier this week that these so-called dreamers have nothing to worry about for 6 months. On the other hand, there have been other people in the administration. Again, we talk about these mixed signals that always emanate from the White House. Other people have said rather ominously that these nearly 700,000 people should plan for life beyond the United States. So despite what the president says, that's what other folks say.
And Dan Raviv, President Trump has basically, we'll go to a break in a bit, but just to begin this, President Trump has said that he wants Congress to pass a law. He doesn't want it to remain on a kind of an executive order that dates from President Obama. Does he have a point that actually it should be Congress that decides the fate of people like this?
He may well have a point, but President Obama decided to act by executive order, starting this DACA program for deferring any deportation order when Congress failed to act. And Congress has failed to act for many years on what's called comprehensive immigration reform. A lot of rules for a lot of foreigners who are in the United States without papers. And so President Obama said, at least I'll have a solution for these young people, the so-called dreamers. By the way, a temporary solution. Each one was given a certificate, usually for 2 years. It always was a big question mark what would happen then.
We'll have more in just a minute. And first, a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, with The Economist. And joining me today are Paul Brandis with West Wing Reports and Dan Raviv of I-24 News. Paul Brandis, if you see President Trump throwing down the gauntlet, saying to Congress, if you think that it's not for a president to decide what happens to these hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of people in the country with the wrong legal status or no legal status, Congress, as Dan says, had several cracks at trying to give, you know, an amnesty or a comprehensive reform that brings these people in from the shadows. Is the problem that there just isn't anything like a majority in Congress for bringing people in out of the shadows? Or actually, is the problem more to do with the politics of one party or the other? Because it's there probably is a majority if the two parties would vote together across party lines. What tell us about the political maths of this.
Well, politically, what's different about Dan made a good point when he said that there have been prior efforts in recent years. What's different now, however, is that you have a Republican, well, in theory, a Republican president, a Republican-dominated House, a Republican-dominated Senate. So in essence, the planets have lined up for something to happen. The problem, though, as we've seen, is that the Republicans, even though they control everything, have been largely incapable of getting anything done. Politically, the time is right for them to do it. But even within the Republican Party, there are splits. There are hardliners who say, no, we have to get these people out. They were here illegally. It's unconstitutional. But then there are people who see the polls. Even a lot of President Trump's base supports immigration in general. They see the economic value of it. They are contributing to American society. People understand that. So the prospect of kicking them out of the only country, frankly, that most of them have known is just a deplorable, even to some Republicans.
I've noticed that in general, the business community also favors letting at least these young people, the so-called dreamers, stay in the U.S., but also favors immigration, as especially the high-tech industries are pointing out that many people who come from other countries have been so valuable in the United States. Now, especially if they get their higher education here in the U.S. And so American business is lobbying the White House quite hard to be softer on immigration, stop being so hardline. I think the Trump administration is looking for a way.
And isn't that one of the odd things, Dan Raviv, that we've been used for a long time here in Washington to thinking in terms of people who are moderates and hardline. So we had that kind of Dan Pat. We knew that the reason that many members of Congress were too scared to reform immigration was that they were frightened that the real hardliners who choose the candidates election time would come after them and say, you're not a proper Republican, you're not a proper conservative. So they lived in fear of those kind of challenges where they could lose their job just because their own party turned against them. So we thought we understood that that was the problem with American politics. Along comes Donald Trump, who seems to have the support of the most hardline voters, but he himself uniquely does not need to do the same hardline things.
That's a great point.
One of the ways that we're so, this is scrambling everything we thought we understood?
Absolutely. And Trump promised to be a disruptor and be different and not be beholden to the usual interests. Skeptics, his critics, say he's now beholden to others who have his ear and suggest things. And they often have been business people, but we're just not sure. It was someone named Steve Bannon who was forced out of the White House. And now from outside, at the same time, he says, I'm supporting President Trump from outside, but I'm absolutely making sure that he stays loyal to the working class of America who elected him. And these are all pressures on Trump, who listens to the media incessantly more than, I don't think this is an insult, I think it's a fact, he listens to the media more than he reads books.
Let's turn to Asia. And a story which has really, I think, sort of got onto the Washington radar rather late. People had been quite optimistic that Myanmar was turning a corner, was going to become more democratic. They were very happy to see Aung San Suu Kyi, longtime political opposition leader, become, in a sense, the de facto leader of the government. But suddenly, out of kind of left field, Washington supporters of Aung San Suu Kyi and that Myanmar government are watching a really gigantic humanitarian refugee crisis involving a Muslim minority, the Rohingya. Paul, tell us what has been happening just in the last kind of couple of weeks.
Well, the Rohingya are a Muslim group that has lived in Myanmar, some call it Burma, yet they have been persecuted. There have been some very good reporting by the BBC and others on the Rohingya being raped and tortured and so forth. As a result, a lot of them have fled or trying to flee, which has caused still more problems. It's a story, frankly, that, as you say correctly, is kind of a late on the Washington radar. But I think the thing that surprises people here the most is that the Nobel Peace Laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, has almost, the view from here at least, kind of looked the other way, which is surprising given her own background and history with that repressive government. We've also seen the State Department not really seem to care very much or get involved, which is reflective of sort of the Trump administration's priorities. It does not seem to be an issue for them, and that's where we are.
Dan Raviv, I mean, the numbers are really big, no? I mean, it's hard, obviously, to measure these things, but we have, I think the United Nations has talked about more than 100,000 Rohingya Muslims arriving in Bangladesh in kind of 10 days.
And anyone who knows about Bangladesh knows that it doesn't really have the facilities and capabilities to take care of even more poor people and refugees, but you do what you have to. That's from a Bangladeshi point of view, but in Burma or Myanmar, well, you know, the word is, you know, even from Western diplomats, that Aung San Suu Kyi is trying to get along. She's considered the de facto leader, a former human rights heroine around the world. Do you remember President Barack Obama visited her and was absolutely thrilled and said the world was that she's now free and what a symbol it is. And so Western diplomats say that she is reluctant to once again go up against the military, who control a lot of what happens in Myanmar. And so she's a big disappointment. And that's a world factor.
And beyond the idea of kind of civilian politicians good, military bad, there's a problem with nationalist politics in Myanmar too. Now, you have Buddhist nationalists, including a Buddhist monk, has his own nationalist movement, who have been saying very, very ferocious anti-Muslim, sort of sectarian statements, which have been whipping people up. I mean, she's dealing as well with kind of just grubby politics. Is that where we are?
And we never expect that from a human rights hero, that they'll have to deal with politics. As I say, Western diplomats think she's trying to get along, but many are waiting for a strong statement from the State Department here in Washington, and the world hasn't seen it so far.
Turning to another arm of the State Department, the United Nations ambassador, who obviously in the American system is a very important figure in any administration, a cabinet rank, and Nikki Haley is a big figure who has this job at the moment. She has been signaling that Congress, which has a long list of very hard issues on its plate, has another one, the Iran deal. So listeners will remember that Barack Obama, with other major world powers, secured this essentially freeze in nuclear weapons activity with Iran. Donald Trump has spent a long time saying it's the worst deal ever, but he hasn't ever quite said he would tear it up, but he has no respect for it. Congress obliges the American president to certify every 90 days that Iran is effectively keeping the terms of this deal. The next time is in October. President Trump signaled last time that he hated signing the piece of paper saying that Iran was in compliance. Paul, what did Nikki Haley say in a quite important speech to a think tank here in Washington when she explained that President Trump might not sign the compliance sign-off next month, and that that actually puts the ball in Congress's court? How does that work?
Well, the first thing is that it's important to remember, and I think people forget this, that this is not a U.S.-Iran deal. It's a U.S., Germany, France, Britain, Russia, China deal with Iran, the so-called P5 plus one. And yet Nikki Haley, President Trump, sometimes they talk about it as if it's almost some kind of a bilateral agreement.
And that's a tremendously important point, because if America did decide to walk away from that deal, those other countries that you just mentioned, are they in the mood to come back to the table and redesign a better deal that might please Donald Trump?
They've indicated that they are not. This deal took years to arrange. Angela Merkel in Germany has said, no, this is a good deal. It appears to be working. I don't think Russia and China have the appetite to do it. So President Trump, who, by the way, says that all deals are bad. He said the Iran deal is bad. The Paris climate deal is bad. NAFTA is bad. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal is bad, and so forth. It's all bad, and only he can fix it. But again, the fact of the matter is, for him to open up this Pandora's box of saying, well, we have to do something about this deal, I think is just messy beyond his ability to comprehend.
Dan Raviv, tell us about what happens next. So Donald Trump has to say either Iran is obeying the terms of the deal or Iran is cheating. But then it's not exactly up to him. Congress has to decide whether to reimpose the very tough sanctions that were the teeth before this deal. And the deal essentially was a deal about lifting sanctions. Is that Congress's decision, or is that the president's decision to reimpose those sanctions if Iran is found to be cheating?
Step one would be Congress. Step two would be the Trump administration, whether to actually carry them out and impose sanctions once they are authorized. Now, the Trump administration, of course, would be in a mood to do so, but let me give you a date. It's October 15th, 5 weeks from now. That's when the next 90-day mark comes up, at which the president has to say whether Iran is abiding by the terms or not. He is really looking for evidence that Iran isn't. And there are Trump administration officials who say there is a lot of evidence, not so much about the nuclear work, but related work on missiles and other Iranian activities. And there's an argument within the Trump administration and certainly the so-called think tanks here in Washington as to what is related. Can President Trump really say Iran is violating the deal if so-called related work on missiles, maybe support for alleged terrorists, is really what they're talking about?
And tell me about the role of Israel, because we saw some really dramatic scenes in the last years of President Obama's term, where the Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, lobbied ferociously against the Iran deal. Is the Israeli government rooting for Donald Trump to say Iran is cheating? Question one. But question two, is the Israeli government keen for the entire deal to go away, collapse, blow up, or are they playing a slightly more subtle game?
Well, there is a more subtle game, but the less subtle side is that Israel wants Iran to be exposed as a country that supports terrorism, as a country that is cheating on agreements, and so Israel would like the deal actually to fall apart. But Israel is realistic and sees that other countries will keep working with Iran. So Israel just says, okay, let's have some evidence against Iran, please. And meanwhile, Israel plans its own defenses and offensive capabilities.
And very briefly, just in 30 seconds, Paul, is the military kind of, you know, saying, yeah, let's have this war, we can take out the Iran nuclear program easily, or are they offering caution in advice?
There have been war games that the Pentagon and think tanks have played that suggest getting into a war with Iran would be extremely difficult in general.
That's all the time we have. And thank you to Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and Dan Raviv of I-24 News. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. The engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.